After I left Hasalalo back at Venus Genetrix, after I stopped at my hotel room and removed the rock tumbler I kept in my luggage and started the gastrolith's polishing, I went to see Avariel. I knew where she'd be. Down Blackstone's single street to where it plunged into a tunnel of plexiglass and steel and down under the slow waves to undersea port proper. There the light was dim and green, more suited to Shrilyala eyes than ours, and the odour of brine and fish dominated, mingling with the cinnamon exhalations of Shrilyala. Here were the markets for the fish and kelp and other niceties that formed the trade between Shrilyala and human. Here were the water-filled chambers where human delegates and negotiators could meet with Shrilyala officials. Here was the interface between two worlds and two species. Avariel and her support crew had taken one of the subs docked there. The street hatch was open, so I went in. I found her in the lower chamber, checking out the diving equipment with a man who'd been part of our support crew last time, Mikhail.
The fiddling I did with the CCR should give you at least another 2 hours if you need it. You bought the best rebreather on the market, I know, but now it's better, he was saying to her.
I hope so, Avariel said. Then she saw me. She gave me the expression of someone suffering from severe acid reflux. Mikhail, she said, why don't you check with Patrick on the comm unit? Mikhail raised a dark eyebrow toward me, the brow rising higher and his mud-brown eyes widening slightly as he noted my missing legs.
Sure, he said.
He was trying not to stare at me.
I'll do that. Hey, Tomio.
Mikhail, good to see you again. The polite thing you say when you're really saying nothing at all.
You too,
he answered, words equally as empty. Then he glanced at Avariel, shrugged, and left, climbing the ladder to the upper compartment. I watched his legs disappear, but Avariel's voice pulled me back. What do you want, Tomio? I'm rather busy right now. You already know. And I already gave you the answer. No, you can't go with me. Not this time. I saw her gaze fall down past my waist to the emptiness there. I can still swim, I told her, stomping the foot end of the prosthetic field for emphasis. The sole of the shoe was rubber. There wasn't much sound, even in the hard-walled chamber. That's not the problem. No, she answered quietly. That's not the problem at all. You're taking Mikhail or Patrick? She was already shaking her head. I'm doing this alone. That's ridiculous and foolish. She gave a cough that might have been a laugh. Is it? Were you there when I climbed the last cliffs at Olympus Mons? That final ascent? I know, I told her. You did it on your own. Doesn't make it any less... I stopped. Stupid was the word on my lips. I could see from her face that she knew it too. I could also see that the more I argued, the more her answer to me wasn't going to change. And I could also tell from the release of tension in my gut that I'd wanted her to tell me no. Because the ghost that I was chasing didn't involve returning to where the great darkness had taken my legs. That ghost was standing in front of me. Avariel took a long breath, closing her eyes momentarily as if composing words in her head. Then she looked at me again, her eyes bright. Look, Tomio, I know what I am. An adrenaline junkie. Someone who likes to push the envelope, to do things that no one else has done. And yeah, I like the attention that gets me too. Your grandmother had me tagged pretty well, and I know myself well enough to admit it now. I don't think you ever knew what you wanted. After your accident in the Great Darkness... She caught her upper lip in her teeth momentarily, as if biting back something. Mikhail told me afterward that when Avariel came for me, my legs were already gone, crudely guillotined from my body by the rocks. She managed to put tourniquets around the stumps and take me back up to the sub before I entirely bled out. When I came back to consciousness, several days later, she'd already left Venus. I'm not proud that I left you. But you and me, her head shook. I waited. It wasn't going to work. I think you knew that as much as I did. I don't know, I told her. At the time, I had other things on my mind, like wondering when I'd ever walk again. She sucked in her breath, a hiss like Hasalalo's bubbler, and I was suddenly repentant. All right, I told her. Can I at least be there tomorrow when you dive? I could help Mikhail and Patrick up top. I thought she was going to say no once more. She looked away from me and down to the dive equipment on the floor. Her head was still shaking, but she took a step toward me, grabbing my hands and looking up into my face. I could see the lines on her face, carved deeper than I remembered. The brown puffiness under her eyes, the small scars on her skin from the burn regeneration. Her fingers pressed mine tightly. It was the closest we'd been since the night she'd left me in the hospital here. If that's what you want, she said, then all right. For what we once were. For what happened last time. Then she let go of my hands and stepped back. If you're going to be here, then at least help me store this crap, she said. The sub was stationed over the broken rim of the Great Darkness, seemingly perched on great legs of blue-white spotlights, as insubstantial as my own. The Always Sea was deepening here, sloping down the submerged flanks of the volcano that was Blackstone Mountain. Staring out the wide, transparent ports of the sub, I could see several Shrilyala gathered at the rim of the Great Darkness below us with the rounded, woven structures of the Shrilyala's Blackstone Village, our name for it, not theirs, receding away into the green-blue distance toward where its seaweed-draped outskirts met the human buildings of Undersea Port. On the rim of the Great Darkness, a great and wide forest of blue-black kelp undulated in the slow currents of the Always Sea. The Shrilyala were gathered above the canopy of kelp, and I could see the bubbling forms of Shrilyala speech as they spoke amongst themselves. The words of the Shrilyala language are essentially shaped water and air bubble structures, which is why they resort to English when out of the water, as much visual as audible. The scientists studying their language are still trying to discern the grammar and construction and putting together a dictionary, but I doubt that any human is ever going to be able to speak or understand Shrilyala without mechanical help. Smelling cinnamon, I spoke aloud. I wonder what they're saying. Hasalalo, aboard the sub with us, peered over my shoulder to the scene below.
They're not pleased that this is happening, it said. Many of us, especially those of Bones of Stone, weren't pleased with the Green Council's decision. They say it is Bones of Air stupidity to permit this.
A long finger stroked the marking on its skull reflexively.
They're not going to try to stop us, are they? Mikhail asked from his console.
Mikhail's finger hovered above the comm button. On the screen in front of him, we could see Avariel in the dive chamber, with Patrick helping her fit on the last of her gear. Hasalalo's eyes widened.
They don't think they'll have to. The lights in water will do that for them.
Mikhail laughed at that, and his finger moved away from the comm.
The lights in water haven't met Avariel. That woman's got a nasty mean streak for people who get in her way.
He chuckled again, then glanced at me. The chuckle died. Is that what you think? I asked Hasalalo. The lights in water will stop Avariel. It looked at me placidly. The bubbler gurgled and spat water.
They stopped you.
Movement. A flash of brilliance accompanied the pain. Then nothing, until I woke up in the hospital. It was a rock fall that stopped me. I got too close to the edge and hit something unstable, I told it.
I wonder, Hasalalo answered, what truth was buried inside those rocks that took your legs?
I started to answer it, but Avariel's voice came over the comm and the holoscreens lit up around the compartment. Going live, she said, her voice muffled through the rebriefer. Do you have the feed, Mikhail?
Got it, Mikhail answered. Everything looks good here.
Fine. I'm going down then. Wish me luck. Luck, I whispered under my breath.
No luck needed, Mikhail told her. You got this. Piece of cake.
The image on the holoscreens bounced and swirled, then filled with bubbles as the dive hatch filled with water and opened for her. Avariel swam out into the haze of the sub's lights, the view on the screen swaying dizzily as she looked up and the camera on her mask picked up the sub above her. Our lights overloaded the camera until it dimmed, then opened up again as she glanced over at the Shrilyala gathered at the lips of the canyon, watching her and speaking to each other in a rush of half-glimpsed water shapes. Behind us, we heard Patrick clamber up the metal ladder into our chamber and settle down by the comm unit.
"Hey, Avariel, you're green across the board here," Patrick said. "Ready?"
She looked down, and we saw the blue-black below that the sub's light could not penetrate. Her arm came into view, laden with her dive watch and depth instrumentation.
"Everything looks green here too," she said. "Patrick, Mikhail, I'm heading down."
I tried not to feel insulted by the lack of any reference to me. On the screens, we watched the water around her slowly darken and the readout from her depth gauge climb just as slowly. She stayed near the edge of the canyon wall, as we had both done the last time, but not, I noted, as closely as I had clung to it. As the sub's light faded, she switched on the mask's headlamps, and we could occasionally catch glimpses of the jagged volcanic rock of the lava tube that was the Great Darkness, adorned with Venusian kelp and the creatures who lived there amongst the rocks and vegetation. I remembered that much myself. The walls of the Great Darkness had been alive in front of me. I saw angler worms dangling their fish-shaped heads outward into the water, enticing the snaggle-mouth puffers to come close enough to be speared by the poison lance of their tongues. I watched a wave of green painters undulate past me, the inky dye from their bodies leaving swirling trails of purple as they passed. Snorting shells with their long spires and carapaces swirled with brilliant blues, yellows and reds, belched air as they made their way along the ledges of the Great Darkness. The shallow waters of the Always Sea teemed with life everywhere. There were species unseen by any human to be discovered everywhere we looked, and we could have spent days cataloguing and describing them, but Avariel was intent only on going down into the blackness. Down and down. I knew that Avariel would be starting to feel the pressure building against her flexible suit, which would be hardening against the weight of the water. The suit she wore was a hybrid, self-contained and powered only by Avariel's legs, but also a miniature vessel that would allow her to reach depths that an individual diver would not be able to reach. Because, for religious reasons, the Shrilyala had refused to allow us to probe the Great Darkness with the remote control vehicles, we had no idea of the actual depth of the lava tube, though indirect estimates suggested that it was no more than 800 meters. The hissing of the rebreather would be loud in her ears, and the canyon walls she followed down became stripped of the kelp, which needed the faint, cloud-shielded sunlight that was mostly non-existent below 75 to 100 meters. Instead, the rocks were dotted with the grey-white tubes of puffworms and the lacy, swollen cells of prison crabs, laden with the bones of the fish they'd snagged with their long, prehensile tails. "I'm at 210 meters," Avariel said, her voice becoming distorted in pitch as the rebreather added more helium and neon to the air she was breathing. I knew why she mentioned it. That's where I'd had my accident, where she'd been forced to abandon the quest the last time. She was well away from the canyon wall now, the lights on her mask illuminating only dark, empty water. She wasn't going to repeat my mistake. The dive meter display showed 280 meters when it happened.
"There's something," they heard Avariel say, "coming up from below. Lights!"
In the view screen, the camera swayed as she looked down, and we saw a swarm of firefly lights, green and cold, swirling below like a flock of phosphorescent birds and rising as they grew larger.
"I can feel them."
The sense of something approaching, then the pain, the terrible pain that sent me whirling into unconsciousness.
"Avariel," I said,
leaning over Patrick's console,
"be careful." "I don't believe," she began,
but the lights rushed inward, too bright, too huge, and the camera view tumbled wildly as they heard Avariel cry out,
"No! Don't!"
Then the screens all went dark at once. The readouts went to flatline, and there was only the hiss of static in the speakers.
"Avariel!" I shouted, though I already knew I was too late. "Avariel!"
Silence.
I heard Mikhail cursing at his console. "I'm taking us down," he said. "We'll go and get her."
"No!"
That was Hasalalo, its voice shrill through the bubbler.
"That is not permitted. The Green Council forbids it. I forbid it."
"Fuck both you and the Green Council," Mikhail ranted. "We have to do something. Patrick, give me her last position." I put my hand on Mikhail's shoulder. He pushed it away. "You can't," I told him. Patrick hadn't moved, staring at all of us. Avariel knew the risks.
"And last time she brought you back," Mikhail answered.
"Not all of me," I answered. "Some of me is still down there." "She knew the risks," I repeated. He stared at me. He cursed again, punching a closed fist on the console. A screen sparked in static at the punishment. Then he let his hands drop to his side. We waited, hovering above the great darkness until an hour after her air should have run out. Then, in furious silence and grief, we headed back to Undersea Port. I stood at the shore of the Always Sea. The rain was a bare drizzler, fat drops falling from scudding grey-black clouds as the wind frothed the tips of the low rollers coming in. Lightning from a storm near the horizon licked bright tongues into the sea. I'd left the rain shield behind in my room. If Venus wanted me to get wet, I'd oblige her and allow it to happen. I imagined the gods of Venus spitting on me from the eternal cloud banks and laughing when one of the droplets hit me. I stared out toward the great darkness, half believing I could see the darkness of it, even though I knew that was impossible. Avariel's body never came back up. I imagined her bones down there with all the others, with a few of mine as well. I heard the scrape of a flippered foot on the rocks and the hiss of a bubbler behind me, and glanced over my shoulder to see Hasalalo there. It stood alongside me, silent except for the noise of the bubbler.
"The Green Council has closed the Great Darkness to all further human exploration," it said. "None of your kind will ever do what Avariel attempted."
It was staring at me. I took a long breath, then plunged my hand into my pocket. I pulled out the stomach stone I'd taken from the pit. It shone in the rain and the diffuse light from the eternally clouded sky. Marbled blue highlights in a swirling orange-red matrix. Gorgeous and oddly heavy. "Here," I told it. "You wanted to see the truth hiding in the stone? Here it is." I took its hand and put the finished piece on its scaled flesh, the polished surface glinting like a wet jewel. Hasalalo's bubbler burbled as it stared, prodding the stone with a webbed finger. Its huge eyes looked up.
"There was great beauty inside," it said. "How could the lights in water not love such a thing if they could see it? If someone gave it to them."
I nodded. I thought it would keep the stone, but Hasalalo handed the stomach stone back to me. I put it in my pocket to nestle with the other stones. Avariel, Venus, the last time. Neither of us said anything for a time, just watching the rain-pocked rollers coming in off the Always Sea.
"You'll be leaving,"
Hasalalo said finally. I shook my head. "No," I told it. "I think I'll stay here for a while. Maybe you were right about seeing truth. I've always moved around. For once, I think I'll try staying long enough to see what's underneath the surface. Maybe I'll even figure out what the lights and water are." Hasalalo seemed to contemplate that.
"You will live longer than me," it said finally, slowly. "When I die, if you're still here..."
It stopped. It was staring out at the misty horizon where the great darkness lay. "If I'm still here," I prodded.
"They will throw my body into the pit after the wrigglers have taken my flesh. Would you come for my stomach stones? Would you find the truth inside them? And would you..."
Hasalalo didn't finish, but it looked out toward the great darkness through the rain, and I knew what it wanted. I nodded. I will, I told it. I promise.
Eleanor Arneson. Eleanor Arneson published her first novel, The Swordsmith, in 1978, and followed it with novels such as Daughter of the Bear King and To the Resurrection Station. In 1991, she published her best-known novel, one of the strongest novels of the 90s, the critically acclaimed A Woman of the Iron People, a complex and substantial novel that won the prestigious James Tiptree Jr. Award. Her short fiction has appeared in Asimov's Science Fiction, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Amazing, Orbit, Xanadu, and elsewhere. Her other books are Ring of Swords and Tomb of the Fathers, and a chapbook, Mammoths of the Great Plains, which includes the eponymous novella, plus an interview with her and a long essay. Her most recent book is a collection, Big Mama Stories. Her story, Stellar Harvest, was a Hugo finalist in 2000. She lives in St. Paul, Minnesota. Here she takes us along with a National Geographic safari headed out of Venusport to the wildest part of the Venusian outback in search of dramatic wildlife footage, and where they find something much more dramatic than they had anticipated.
Ruins by Eleanor Arneson. Read for you by Mandy Williams. Of course, the story began in a low dive in Venusport, in the slums up on the hillside above the harbour. The proper town was below them, grid streets with streetlights, solid, handsome concrete houses and apartment blocks. The people in the apartments, middle class and working folks with steady jobs, had their furniture volume printed in one of the city's big plants. The rich folks in their houses patronized custom printing shops, where they could get any kind of furniture in any style. The rich man in his castle, the poor man at his gate, God printed out the both of them and ordered their estate. Not that it mattered up on the hill. The people here scraped by without regular jobs that could be relied on. There were always layoffs when construction was cut back, or the equipment from Earth did not arrive. If there were God-given rules for their lives, they didn't know them. The bar Ash was in had beat up previously owned chairs and tables. A dehumidifier heating unit glowed against one wall because it was winter, and the usual winter rains fell heavily outside. It wasn't cold that was a problem. No place on Venus was really cold, except the tops of a few tall mountains, but the damp could get in your bones. Ash sat in a corner, her back against a wall. On the table in front of her was a glass of beer and a tablet. She was playing solitaire on the tablet. The game occupied her mind just enough to keep out old memories, but left her with attention for the bar. It could be dangerous on payday nights, when people were flush and drunk, or after big layoffs, when people were angry and spending their last money. Tonight, it was mostly empty. The guy who walked in, there was always someone walking in at the start of a story, did not belong. He was short and neatly dressed, with a fancy vest full of pockets, and his head was shaved, except for a few tufts of bright blue hair. It was a kind of haircut that required upkeep. Most people in Hillside didn't bother. He stopped at the bar and spoke to the bartender, who nodded toward Ash. The man bought a glass of wine, which was a mistake, as he would find when he tasted it, then walked over. She had no chance of winning the current game and turned the tablet off. "Hong Wu," he said in introduction. "I'm an editor with National Geographic." "Yes?" She nodded toward the chair opposite. The man sat down, took a sip of his wine, and made a face. "You are Ash Weatherman?" "Yes." "We want to do a story about the megafauna on Venus, and we want to hire you." "The story's been done," Ash said. "We think another look at the megafauna is worth it. We did 1,000 stories about wild animals in Africa until they were gone. People could never get enough of elephants and lions. They still can't. Look at zoos. She had grown up on National Geographic videos, all the lost wilderness of Earth, the charismatic megafauna of land and ocean. Most had been mammals, of course, and near relatives to humanity. Nothing on Venus was as closely related, although pretty much everyone agreed that life on Venus had come from Earth, most likely via a meteorite that hit Earth a glancing blow, then landed on the inner planet, bringing Terran organisms scraped up in the first collision. Geologists thought they had found the crater on Earth and the final resting place on Venus. Both craters were eroded and filled in, not visible on the planetary surface. The Great Plain of Ishtar and something whacking big in Greenland. There were people who thought it had happened twice, with the second meteorite bringing organisms from a later era, and they had found another pair of craters, but whatever had happened was long ago, and the organisms that came to Venus were single-celled. They had their own evolutionary history, which had ended in a different place with no cute furry mammals. "The fauna here are certainly big enough," she said out loud, "though I don't know how charismatic they are." She tapped her tablet and a new game of solitaire appeared. "What do you know about me?" "You grew up in Hillside, graduated from high school here, and got a degree in the history of evolutionary theory at Venusport College. According to the police, you were involved with a student anarchist group, but did nothing illegal. You worked in a printing plant while you were in college, and after, until your photography began to sell. For the most part, you do advertising. Fashion, such as it is on Venus, furniture and real estate, and nature shots for the tourism industry. On the side, you do your own work, which is mostly images of the Venusian outback. That work is extraordinary. We have our own first-rate videographer and a thoughtful journalist, but we think it would be interesting to have a Venusian perspective." Interesting that they'd seen her photos. They had shown at a small gallery downtown. 3D blow-ups on the walls and a machine in back to print copies with a signature. Ashley Weatherman, 2113. She'd made some money. People safe in Venusport liked to have the Venusian wilderness on their walls. Cone-shaped flowers, 2 meters tall, brilliant yellow or orange, amphibianoids that looked more or less like giant crocodiles, and little rapid bipedal reptiloids. "You're going to need someone to organize your safari," Ash said. "Do you have anyone?"
"We thought we'd ask you."
"Arkady Volkov. You're going to want to go to Aphrodite Terra. That's where the best megafauna are, and you won't want to deal with any corporations. Most of Ishtar Terra is company land. Believe me, they protect it." Hong Wu nodded.
"Rare earth mining and timeshare condos."
"Arkady knows the territory," Ash said. "I've worked with him before."
Hong Wu nodded a second time. "We know. The police here say he's reputable, even though he comes from Petrograd."
The last Soviet Socialist Republic, which remained here on Venus long after the collapse of the USSR, an enclave of out-of-date politics on the larger of the two Venusian continents. She liked Arkady, even though he was a Leninist. "The heart hath its reasons that reason knoweth not." "Are you willing to hire him?"
"Yes," Hong Wu said.
The rest of the conversation was details. Hong Wu left finally. Ash ordered another beer. The bartender asked, "What was that about?"
"Work."
"He looked like a petunia." "He is an employer, and we will be respectful." "Yes, ma'am." The bartender grinned, showing metal teeth. She finished the beer and walked home through winter rain, not hurrying. Her parka was waterproof, and the streets were covered with mud that had washed down from eroded hillsides. Half the streetlights were out. It would be easy to slip on the badly lit, uneven surface. She hated getting muddy. Even more, she hated looking vulnerable. The buildings she passed were concrete and low, row houses for families and barracks for single workers. Graffiti crawled over them, most of it dark and slow-moving. Here and there were tags written in more expensive spray that jittered and sparkled. "Revolution Now," one said in glowing red letters. "F-U, F-U, F-U," another said in flashing yellow. The tags wouldn't last downtown, where the ambulance cops would cover them. But here... There were shanties and tents in the supposedly empty lots, mostly hidden by vegetation. You could see them if you knew how to look. Some folks did not like living in barracks, and some didn't have the money to pay bed rent. She turned a corner next to a lot full of tall, feathery pseudograss. In daylight, it would have been deep green, edged with purple. Now, it was as black as the graffiti on the nearest building. In the street ahead, a pack of pig-like amphibianoids nosed around a dumpster, mostly not dangerous in spite of their impressive tusks and claws. Ash paused. The matriarch of the pack eyed her for a moment, then grunted and lumbered away. The rest followed, leaving heaps of dung. Her place was past the dumpster, a two-floor row house. A light shone over the door, making it possible for her to see the land scorpion resting on the step. More than anything else, it looked like the ancient sea scorpions of Earth, broad, flat, segmented, and ugly. Instead of swimming paddles, it had many legs. This one was dull green and as long as her foot. Most likely it wasn't venomous. The toxic species advertised the fact with bright colors. Nonetheless, she stepped on it firmly, hearing the crack of its exoskeleton breaking, then scraped her boot on the edge of the step. She unlocked the door and yelled a greeting to the family on the first floor. Bangladeshi. The smell of their curries filled the house, and if she was lucky, they invited her to dinner. Tonight she was too late. Ash climbed the stairs and unlocked another door. Lights came on. Baby, her pet pterosaur, called.
Hungry?
She pulled off her boots and put a stick of chow in Baby's cage. The pterosaur dug in. Of course the animal was not a real pterosaur. Life on Earth and Venus had been evolving separately for hundreds of millions, maybe billions of years. But it had skin wings stretched over finger bones, a big head, and a small light body. Pale yellow fuzz covered it, except around its eyes, where its skin was bare and red. A crest of feathers adorned Baby's head, down at present. When up, the feathers were long and narrow, looking like spines or stiff hairs, and they were bright, iridescent blue. Some people, mostly middle class, used the Latin names for the local life, but people on the hill called them after the earth life they most resembled.
Bored?
The animal said. We're going into the outback, Ash said. Flying, baby. Hunting. Food.
Fly, baby sang. Hunt! Food!
She scratched the pterosaur's muzzle, which was full of needle teeth. Their head crest rose, expanding into a brilliant semicircular array. Venus was surprising, she had learned in school. No one had expected flying animals as intelligent as birds. Famous words repeated over and over. No one had expected. She pulled a beer out of the electric cooler, sat down in the chair next to Baby's cage, and unfolded her tablet. One tap brought up Arcadi's address. As usual, it was irritating. A glowing red star appeared on her screen.
You have reached the home of Arkady Volkov. He is out at present, making plans for a new revolution. But if you leave a message...
Cut it out, Arkady, Ash said. You are down at the local bar getting pissed.
The star was replaced by Arkady, a swarthy man with a thick black beard and green eyes, surprisingly pale given his skin and hair.
Do not judge others by yourself, Ash. I'm sitting at home with a modest glass of wine, trying, once again, to understand the first three chapters of Capital. Why bother? Education is always good. The ruling class denies it to workers because it's dangerous to them. As a rule, one should always do what the ruling class finds dangerous.
Easy for him to say, living in Petrograd, where his opinions were tolerated because a ruling class did not officially exist. Even there, most people found his ideas out of date. Oh, silly Arkady. He believes the old lies.
Did you call to banter? Arkady asked, or to argue politics, in which case I will find something offensive to say about anarchism.
Neither, Ash said, and told him about the job. He looked dubious.
I wasn't planning to go out in the near future. There are things in Petrograd that need to be dealt with. Do these people pay well?
Ash gave him the figure. Arkady whistled.
Who are they?
National Geographic. They want to do a story on charismatic megafauna. I want to take them into a real wilderness where they won't run into surveyors or test plots or mines.
I will do it, Arkady said, and lifted his glass of wine to her. Capitalists have so much money. How many people?
She gave details, as she had learned them from Hong Wu.
Two vehicles, Arkady said. Ural trucks modified for passengers. Rifles, I can provide those. We'll need two drivers and a cook, all of whom should be good with guns. That means we'll have to hire the cook in Petrograd. Your cuisine is better, but your shooting is worse, and most of you do not know how to handle a Pechenegg.
In theory, a rifle could take down anything on Venus, but only if the shot was well placed. There were times when the best thing to do was to rip the animal apart, and a Pechenegg could do that. Arkady was fond of them. They were solid and reliable, like the legendary AK-47 and the Ural 6420, the last version of the truck made before the USSR fell. It had been designed for use on Venus as well as in Siberia, and it could go through almost everything.
I know someone here in Petrograd who does an excellent borscht. A man could live on borscht and bread, and can make more than adequate Central Asian food. She was in the police force and can both fire a Pechenegg and field strip it.
It's a deal then, said Ash. She met the National Geographic team in the Venusport airport. The journalist was as expected, a tall, lean man in a jacket with many pockets. His dark eyes had a 1,000-kilometer stare. The videographer was a surprise, a round sphere that rested on four spidery metal legs. Its head was atop a long, flexible neck, a cluster of lenses.
You are Ash Weatherman? The machine asked in a pleasant contralto voice.
Yes.
I am an autonomous Leica. My model name is AL-26. My personal name is Margaret, in honor of the 20th century photographer Margaret Burke White. You may call me Maggie.
It lifted one of its legs and extruded fingers. Ash shook the cool metal hand.
And I am Jason Kahn, the journalist said, holding out his hand, which was brown and muscular.
More shaking. This time the hand was warm.
Baby, said Baby.
And this is Baby. Don't try to shake. He nips.
A pseudoramphorhynchus, Jason said.
Not pseudo, Baby said.
How large is his vocabulary? Maggie asked.
More than 500 words. He keeps picking up new ones. Maggie bent its neck, peering into the cage.
Say cheese.
Not in vocabulary,
Baby replied, then opened his mouth wide, showing off his needle teeth.
Excellent, said Maggie.
A bright light came on, and the Leica extended its, her,
long neck father curling around the cage, recording baby from all sides. The pterosaur did not look happy.
You will be famous, baby, Ash said.
Want food?
The plane took off on time, rising steeply into the almost always present clouds. Ash had a window seat, useless after the clouds closed in. Baby was next to her on the aisle, and the National Geographic team was across the aisle. 6 hours to Aphrodite Terra. Ash fed a chow stick to Baby. The pterosaur held it in one clawed foot and gnawed. Ash felt her usual comfort in travel and in getting away from Venusport. Petrograd might be retrograde and delusional, the last remnant of a failed idea. But she liked Arcady, and nothing on the planet could beat a Ural 6420. She dozed off as the plane flew south and rain streaked her window, then woke when the descent began. A holographic steward came by and warned them to fasten their seatbelts. She had never unfastened hers, but she checked the one around Baby's cage. She looked out as the plane dropped below the clouds. Another grid city like Venusport, but smaller with no tall buildings. A failure, slowly dying according to people on Earth and in Venusport. Cracked grey runways crossed shaggy native grass. They landed with a bump and rolled to a stop in front of the terminal. Ash undid her belt and Baby's, then stood feeling stiff. Arcady was at the gate. On Earth, there was security, which grew more intense as violence grew. Here on Venus, people were less desperate, and it was possible to wait at a gate with an AK-47 over one shoulder. It wasn't the original version, of course, but a modern replica with some improvements, but not many. It remained as simple and indestructible as a stone axe, and as easy to maintain. The best assault weapon ever made, Arcady said. Baby opened his wings as far as he could in the cage.
Arky!
He cried. The Russian grinned and waved. Introductions followed. The two men were wary of each other, in spite of vigorous handshakes and broad smiles. Arcady was warmer toward the robot.
A pleasure, he said, clasping the extruded fingers. The Urals are waiting. We can head out at once.
Excellent, the autonomous Laika said. They picked up the rest of their baggage at the carousel, then went into the rain. The Urals were across the drop-off pickup road. Two massive vehicles, each with four sets of wheels. The front truck had a box. The one in back was a flatbed with a Pechenegg fastened to the bed. A tarp covered it, but Ash knew what it was. Arcady escorted Maggie and Jason to the flatbed, then pointed at the truck in front. Ash climbed into the back seat. The driver made a friendly, grunting sound.
This is Boris, Arcady said as he climbed in. Irina and Alexandra are in the second truck.
The trucks pulled out. Rain beat on the windshield, and wipers flashed back and forth. They bumped out of the airport and along rough, wet streets. Petrograd was around them, low, dreary-looking, concrete buildings dimmed by the rain. Arcady opened a thermos of tea and handed it back to Ash. She took a swallow, hot and sweet.
Do you want to show them anything special? Arcady asked.
They want charismatic megafauna and maybe something else. I keep wondering why they hired me. Do they want to write about Venusian culture as well?
The replica of America on Ishtar Terra and the remains of the USSR on Aphrodite Terra, said Arcady in a genial tone. It might make a good story. At least they did not ask for mostly naked natives. We don't have any, except in saunas and swimming pools.
The city was not large. They were soon out of it and rolling through agricultural land, bright green fields of modified earth crops. The rain let up, though the cloud cover remained. By mid-afternoon, they reached the forest. The
The fields ended at a tall wire fence. Beyond were trees, green of course. Chlorophyll had evolved only once, on Earth, and been imported to Venus. But the native forest's green always seemed richer, more intense and varied to her. Purple dotted the ragged foliage of the low bottle brush trees. The foliage of the far taller lace leaf trees was veined with yellow, though this was hard to see at a distance. The truck stopped. Arkady climbed down and opened the gate, then closed it after the trucks were through, climbed back into the cab, and flipped on the radio.
"Large herbivores can break through the fence and do sometimes," he told the truck in back. "Fortunately for us, they do not like the taste of Terran vegetation, though they can metabolize it. Unfortunately for us, the only way for them to learn they don't like our food is to try it."
"Ah," said Jason. "I got images of your opening the gate," Maggie said. "Bright green fields, dark green trees, and you with your AK-47. Very nice." The trucks drove on. The road was two muddy ruts now, edged by an understory of frilly plants. The air coming in her partly open window smelled of Venus, rain, mud, and the native vegetation. Animals began to appear, pterosaurs flapping in the trees and small reptiloid bipeds in the understory. Now and then, Ash saw a solitary flower, cone-shaped and 2 meters tall. Most were a vivid orange-yellow. The small flying bugs that pollinated them were not visible at a distance, but she knew they were there in the clouds. Now and then, Maggie asked for a stop. Ash had her camera out and did some shooting, but the thing she really wanted to capture, the robot, was invisible, except for the lens head, pushed out a window at the end of Maggie's long, long neck. Midway through the afternoon, they came to a river. A small herd of amphibianoids rested on the far shore. They were larger than the street pigs in Venusport, maybe 5 meters long, their sprawling bodies red and slippery-looking. Their flat heads had bulbous eyes on top, not at the back of the head where eyes usually were, even on Venus, but in front, close to the nostrils and above the mouths full of sharp teeth. Maggie climbed out her window onto the flatbed of the second truck. She braced herself there, next to the Pechenegg, and recorded as the trucks forded the river. The water came up to the truck's windows, and the riverbed was rocky, but the trucks kept moving, rocking and jolting. Nothing could beat a Ural.
"A gutsy robot," Arkady said.
Alexandra answered over the radio.
"She has 4 sets of fingers dug into the truck bed, right into the wood. A good thing. I don't want to fish her out of the river."
Ash aimed her camera at the amphibianoids as the animals bellowed and slid into the river, vanishing among waves. Maggie was more interesting, but she still couldn't get a good view. The trucks climbed the now empty bank and rolled onto the road. The Leica climbed back into the cab.
"Not mega, but very nice," Maggie said over the radio.
An hour or so later, they reached the first lodge, a massive concrete building set against a low cliff. Vines hung down the cliff, and pterosaurs, a small species covered with white down, fluttered among the vines. There was a front yard protected by a tall fence. Once again, Arkady climbed down and opened the gate. The trucks rolled in. Arkady locked the gate behind them. Boris shut down their truck and grabbed an AK-47, climbing down to join Arkady. They looked around the yard, which was full of low vegetation, mashed in places by previous safaris. Nothing big could hide here, but there were always land scorpions. An AK-47 seemed excessive to Ash. Good boots and stomping worked just as well, but the citizens of Petrograd loved their guns, and there was no question that the experience of crushing a land scorpion, especially a big one, was unpleasant. Finally, Boris unlocked the lodge's door, which was metal and so heavy it could be called armored, and went in. She knew what he was doing, turning on the generator. The lights, ah, there they were, shining out the open door. The air, the temp control, the fence. Baby shifted in his cage.
Want out? Hunt? Eat?
Soon.
Pterosaur chow is crap,
Baby added. She reached a finger through the cage's bars and rubbed his head. His large eyes closed and he looked happy. Boris came out and waved.
All clear, Arkady called. The fence is electric and on now. Stay away from it.
Ash opened the cage. Baby crawled out and rested for a moment in the open window. Then he flapped out, rising rapidly. The small pterosaurs in the vines shrieked. She felt the brief doubt she always felt when she let Baby go. Would he return? Did it escape? Jason asked over the radio. He's going hunting. Ash climbed down. The air was damp and hot. By the time she reached the lodge, her shirt was wet.
I want all the food inside, Arkady said. Also all the weapons and any personal belongings you want to preserve. The fence will keep most things out, but it's not 100% secure.
She put the cage down and went back to help unload the trucks. Irina was a broad, box-like woman, as solid and useful as a Ural. Alexandra was surprisingly slim and elegant, the chef who had been a cop and could field-strip a Pechenegg. She moved like a dancer, and Ash felt a terrible envy. Did women ever stop feeling envy? Maggie recorded them as they worked, while Jason took notes on a tablet. Ash felt mildly irritated by this. Couldn't he help with the boxes? But he was a paying customer and an employee of a famous news source. Once they were all inside, Boris shut the door, bringing down a heavy bar.
Bathrooms are down the hall, Arkady said. Paying customers go first. Dinner will be in an hour.
An hour and a half, Alexandra said.
I am corrected.
When she got back from her shower, Ash noticed that the virtual windows were on, showing the yard, lit now by spotlights. Beyond the fence was the dark forest. A hologram fire burned in the fireplace. Wine and a cheese plate were on a table in front of the fire. She poured a glass, then went to help Alexandra and Irina with dinner. It was sautéed vegetables and fish from the Petrograd fish ponds. They ate around the fireplace.
Someone has been here, Boris said as they ate. It must have been another safari, Arkady said mildly. They all have the access code. I checked. No safaris have been this way since the last time we were here, and the security system has recorded nothing. But I know how I arrange canned goods. They are no longer in alphabetic order. I think it's the CIA.
What? Asked Jason, and pulled his tablet out.
There is a CIA post in the forest, Arkady said. They spy on Petrograd, though we're barely surviving and no danger to the American colony or anyone. We ignore them because we don't have the resources to confront them, but they are present and not far from here. Boris might be right. They could have tinkered with the security system. I don't know who else could have.
Why do you hang on if you're barely surviving? Jason asked. The USSR fell in part because it exhausted itself trying to settle Venus. All the republics have become capitalist states, but you remain here, stubbornly Soviet.
Not all change is good, Boris said, and there is more to life than selfishness.
Surely you could do better if you had the assistance of the American colony on Ishtar, Arkady said.
The capitalists on Earth are investing in what interests them, which is not the lives of ordinary people. We in Petrograd are a dream that has failed, or so we are told. Ishtar Terra is a... what can I call it? A vacation spot, a rare earth mine, and a place for the rich to flee to if they finally decide that Earth is uninhabitable. Life in Ishtar Terra is more comfortable than life here, Jason pointed out. We survive. Be honest, Arkady, said the box-like woman Irina. People get tired of shortages and go to Ishtar Terra. It's a slow but continual drain. In the end, Petrograd will fail. We don't know that, Boris put in. Even our setbacks are not entirely bad. Our food shortages have brought our rates of heart disease and diabetes down, and our fuel shortages mean we walk more, which is healthy. Irina did not look convinced, nor did Jason Khan, though Ash could not be sure. He was an oddly opaque man. Maybe she would find out what he was thinking when the article finally came out. At present, the Laika was easier to understand. There, said Arkady. You said you wanted charismatic fauna? He pointed at one of the virtual windows. A flock of bipeds moved along the fence, illuminated by the spotlights. They were slender and covered with bright blue down, except for their chests, which were orange-red. The Americans call them robins, Arkady said. Notice that they are following the fence, but not touching it. They know it's dangerous if we are here, and the spotlights tell them we are here. If this were Earth in a Triassic, those little fellows would be the ancestors of the dinosaurs. But this isn't Earth. We don't know what they will become. They're bright, and they have hands capable of some manipulation. Maybe they will become us in time. A second kind of animal joined the bipeds at the fence. 10 meters long or more, its body was hairless and black. It had a gait like a crocodile's high walk, and its lifted head was long and reptilian, the mouth full of ragged teeth. The bipeds ran off. The animal nosed the fence once and drew back with a roar. You see, Arkady said, not so bright. It doesn't have to be. It's big and nasty. If this were Earth in the Triassic, it would represent the past, a species that will vanish, unable to compete. But this is not Earth. Something pale flew into the spotlights. Baby, Ash realized. The pterosaur flapped low above the pseudosuchus, taunting it. The animal roared and reared up on its hind legs, snapping at Baby and almost getting him. The pterosaur flapped up and over the fence, landing on one of the Urals. The pseudosuchus dropped down on all fours. Most likely Ash was reading in, but it looked frustrated. Baby looked frightened. The little fool. She'd have a talk with him. They are descended from bipeds, Arkady said. As a result, their hind legs are longer and stronger than their front legs, and they can, as you see, rear up. They also move more quickly than you would suspect.
I got it, Maggie said, but the image won't be as good as I could have gotten outside.
Go out, Boris said. This fence is strong enough to hold.
Ash went out with the Nat Geo people. Of course, the pseudosuchus saw, or maybe smelled, them as soon as they went outside. It slammed into the fence and roared, then reared up, grasping the fence with its forepaws and shaking it. That must hurt. More roaring while Maggie recorded, using a light so brilliant that Ash could see the glitter of the animal's scales. Ash got a lovely image of the robot and the monster. Light hit from different angles, cast by the lodge's spots and Maggie, creating areas of glare and shadow. Even in color, the image looked black and white. Baby flapped to her, settling on her shoulder. Idiot, she said.
Poop on you,
Baby replied. The fence bowed under the animal's weight. Behind them, Arkady said,
I'm not going to turn the current up. That is a protected species.
Come in, Ash told Jason. The fence is supposed to hold.
Most likely it will, Arkady said in a comfortable tone. But if it doesn't...
They piled back inside, and Arkady barred the door. Baby flew to his cage, opened the door and climbed in, pulling the door shut. Ash heard the lock click. The pterosaur huddled, looking thoroughly frightened.
You shouldn't tease the monsters, Ash said.
Poop! Poop!
Baby replied, and pooped on the floor of his cage. She would have to clean that up, but not now. Let Baby get over being afraid. She glanced at one of the virtual windows. The Pseudosuchus was back on all fours, looking thoroughly pissed off. After a moment or two, it moved off. It was clear from the way it moved that its forefeet were injured.
Not bright, Arkady said, but a top predator. They do not need to be bright, as the history of America has shown.
I'd like help in the kitchen, Alexandra put in.
Ash gathered glasses and followed Alexandra out of the room. The kitchen had a dishwasher from Venusport. Everything went in. Alexandra set the controls and turned the machine on.
What is Venusport like? Irina asked.
Unjust, Ash replied. Run from Earth for the benefit of mining companies and tourists and the rich.
That sounds like a manifesto, not a report, Alexandra said. What is life like for you? Do you have enough to eat? Can you buy glittery toys?
Ash hesitated, then answered, I have enough to eat. I can buy some toys. Hell, I make most of my living producing images of glittery toys.
We see broadcasts from Ishtar Terra, Irina said. Life there looks more attractive than life in Petrograd.
Are you thinking of bailing out? Ash asked.
Maybe, Alexandra said. I would like glittery toys.
Irina shook her head.
I don't think so. I have family and a lover who is like Arkady. She believes in Petrograd.
Once the counters were wiped down, Ash went back into the living room. Jason and Arkady were lounging in chairs by the fire. Maggie had retracted her legs and neck and head, becoming a large, featureless silver ball in front of the hologram flames. Red light played over her surface. Baby was sitting on top of his cage, eating a stick of chow.
You found nothing to eat? Ash asked.
Caught small pterosaur. Ate it. Still hungry.
She settled in a chair. There was a new bottle on the table, surrounded by fresh glasses. One of Petrograd's scary brandies. Ash poured and tasted. This one was raspberry. It burned in her mouth and down her throat, ending as a warm glow in her gut.
Where's Boris? She asked.
Looking around the lodge, he's still worried about his canned goods.
He really arranged them alphabetically?
Arkady nodded.
He is both compulsive and paranoid, but an excellent safari driver and a good drinking companion. A man as obsessed as he is needs ways to relax. He never drinks while driving, in case you are wondering.
Ash eased back in her chair, feeling content. Brandy, a fire, baby chewing on chow, the prospect of charismatic megafauna and gigantic flowers. Life was good. Jason had his tablet out, his fingers dancing over the screen. She still didn't know what he was reporting on. Venusian wildlife? Petrograd? The American colony? Whatever it was, the pay was good, and she got a break from the glittery toys that Irina and Alexandra envied. She should not judge them. She had the toys, or at least the toy makers, as clients. It was easy for her to feel indifferent to them. Boris came into the room, holding a land scorpion, one hand behind the animal's head, the other on its tail. It was alive and twisting in his grip, trying to find a way to bite him or pinch him with its large front claws.
Shit, said Arkady. How did that get in? I told you someone had been here.
Boris stopped and displayed the creature to them. Jason looked horrified. Maggie, who must have been listening, extruded her head and neck. In a smooth motion, she rose on her legs and the cluster of lenses she had instead of a face turned toward Boris. The scorpion was about half a meter long, wide, flat, shiny, dark purple, and still twisting in Boris's grip. The mouth, with mandibles and fangs, was in continuous motion. Ash felt a little queasy. Damn, the things were ugly. She was pretty certain this species was poisonous. Arkady would know.
Get me a pair of shears, Boris said.
Ash went to the kitchen, where Irina and Alexandra were still talking. We have a problem. I need shears. Alexandra found them. Ash took them to Boris. He knelt carefully and placed the animal on the floor, holding it with one hand. With the other hand, he took the shears and cut the scorpion's head off, then stood quickly. The many-legged body thrashed around, and the head jittered on the floor, its mandibles still opening and closing.
It was under the bed in the room that Jason picked as his bedroom, Boris said.
What is it? Jason asked in a tone of terror.
One of the many species of land scorpion, Arkady said. Many have poisonous bites. This species would not kill you, but it would make you sick.
Boris took one of the glasses on the table and used it to scoop the head up.
The body is not toxic. The fangs and the venom glands are in the head. Keep the rest as a souvenir if you want.
I have dramatic images, Maggie said. That is sufficient. Our viewers will be horrified and disgusted.
How did it get in? Arkady asked again.
I want to take a closer look at the head, Boris said, and went into the kitchen.
Alexandra and Irina were in the living room by now, watching the twisting, scrabbling, headless body with interest.
Edible?
Baby asked. Wait, said Ash.
Hungry,
Baby complained. Have another stick of chow.
Not tasty.
Life is hard, Ash told him.
Do not understand.
Eat your chow. The scorpion's body was slowing down, though it still thrashed.
I hate drama, Alexandra said.
That is why you are a chef now rather than a cop, Arkady told her.
Yes, but it doesn't explain why I work for you.
Money, Arkady said.
Boris came back, carrying the scorpion's head on a cutting board. He set the board on the table, and Maggie leaned down to record it. He'd cut the head open. Some kind of dark matter, the brain most likely, was inside. In the middle of it was a tiny silver bead. Barely visible silver wires radiated out from it.
Most likely it is a nanomachine, Boris said. It was injected into the circulatory system and migrated to the brain, then built itself. The animal has become an organic robot. It was planted on us as a spy.
Ash felt queasy. She had no trouble with ordinary robots, such as Maggie, who was recording the split-open head, but the idea of taking a living being and turning it into a robot bothered her. Even cockroaches, which had come to Venus with humans, deserved their own lives. The technology used to enslave bugs could be modified for other animals or humans, though that was illegal, of course.
How did you know to look for it?
Arkady asked Boris.
I looked at the security recordings. It was there, though only in glimpses. I don't think there are any more.
My images are excellent, Maggie said. This will add drama to our story.
Is it the CIA? Asked Jason.
I believe so, Boris answered. We live in their shadow. Well, if Boris thinks there are no more, we can enjoy the rest of the evening, Arkady put in.
Can baby eat the body? Ash asked.
No, said Boris. We don't know what else might be in it. I'll toss it in the garbage.
Sorry,
baby said. Boris carried the head and body out. Ash drank more raspberry brandy.
We grow the raspberries in greenhouses, along with other fruit, Arkady said. Our crops may fail, but we always have brandy.
Nothing more happened that evening or night. Ash slept badly, waking from time to time to listen for the rustling sound of a scorpion. She turned on the lights once, but saw nothing except baby sleeping in his cage. The next morning, they drove on. The rain stopped, and rays of sunlight broke through the cloud cover, lighting patches of the forest. There were lots of cone-shaped flowers. A group of large herbivores fed on one. Similar animals on Ishtar Terra were called forest cattle, though they didn't seem especially cow-like to her, being larger than any cow she had ever seen, even in images from Earth, and green. A crest of hair went along their backs, and their large mouths had four big tusks. There were half a dozen of them around the bright red flower, ripping into it. Petals coated their muzzles and dripped from their mouths like blood. Boris braked.
Look to the right, Arkady said to the radio. More megafauna.
I would not call them charismatic, Jason replied over the radio.
They are 2 meters high at the shoulder, and they can be dangerous, Arkady said. If you don't believe so, I can let you off here.
No, said Maggie. I need Jason. The trucks moved on. Ash had been on this route before, a loop that went from fortified lodge to fortified lodge till it returned to Petrograd and dinner at one of several luxury hotels. A hospitality firm based in Venusport had built them and ran them, making sure that the tourists had a reliably luxurious experience.
This is National Geographic, she said to Arkady. Can't you show them something different?
We are thinking about that, but not today.
She set down her camera and drank tea. As usual, it was strong and sweet. She felt tired because of a bad night's sleep, but mostly good. Baby was next to her in his cage, hunched up, his eyes closed. Was there anything cuter than a sleeping pterosaur? There were more pterosaurs flapping in the trees and bipeds scurrying through the undergrowth. Early in the afternoon, the clouds broke apart and rays of sunlight slanted into the forest. A herd of forest cattle, 20 or more, crossed the track in front of them, forcing them to stop and wait till the loutish herbivores finally moved on. But they saw no large predators.
Apex predators are always rare, Arkady said when Jason complained. And this is not Earth in the Jurassic.